Economic growth slows to a crawl.
And the Fed isn't coming to the rescue yet.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Stacey Fanick Smith in New York and for Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Friday, August 26th.
Coming up, we'll talk about what the Fed will and won't do to help the economy.
And we'll talk about the big hurricane barreling up the East Coast. Irene is expected to cost billions of dollars.
Those stories and more up ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
We learned this morning that the U.S. economy grew a dismal 1% in the second quarter. That news came ahead of this morning's speech in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, by Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke. Jill Schlesinger joins me now, as she does every Friday. She's editor-at-large for CBS Money Watch. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
So, Jill, what do you think of these economic growth numbers we're seeing this morning?
Well, let's be honest. They stink. The U.S. economy grew by only basically 0.5% in the first full half of the year. My goodness. And so the current recovery, which began 2 years ago, has seen annual growth of about 2.5%. That's less than half the rate enjoyed during previous recoveries. This is really worrisome because indebted consumers and cautious corporations just don't seem ready to propel our limping economy.
Well, Federal Reserve Chief Ben Bernanke is speaking later today. The markets have been gyrating all week in anticipation of the speech. Why is that? Why is this such a big deal?
Well, at this conference last year, Bernanke signaled that the Fed was considering buying bonds to boost the then stalling economy. That was the first time we heard about quantitative easing. And you know, the effect of that announcement was to spark a big 20% multi-month stock market rally. So investors are really keyed in on what he's going to say today.
Did Bernanke's actions last year, quantitative easing, make a difference in the economy?
Well, the Fed had hoped that the last round of bond buying would lead to more robust growth. But in hindsight, we know it didn't. We have those GDP numbers as proof. QE2 didn't improve the employment picture. It didn't help housing. And, you know, with the recent sell-off in global stocks, we know that bond buying only boosted stocks temporarily. So I got to be careful in worrying about whether Bernanke's going to save us this time around.
Jill Schlesinger of CBS Money Watch. Thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
Well, Stacey, we would ordinarily have a lot more on the Fed right now in the podcast, but most of the interviews we did this morning are out of date now that Bernanke has spoken.
So, it's very unfair of the Federal Reserve.
Indeed. He should have spoken earlier. But anyway, on we go to the other big story, the hurricane that has its eye on you, Stacey, and the city of New York. Are you ready?
I have purchased an itty-bitty book light and Fig Newtons. So, yes.
Hopefully that'll get you through. Good.
Hurricane Irene is, of course, charging towards North Carolina this morning. The storm is projected to surge up the Atlantic coast, brushing by New York City. As Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports, Irene will also hit all sorts of businesses.
This storm is giving insurers more headaches than usual. It's not the strength of the storm that's causing the most worry. It's Irene's path. Michael Berry is a spokesman for the Insurance Information Institute. He says Irene will be one of the most significant hurricanes to hit the East Coast in years, and it's expected to affect a lot of people in the New York City area, including on Long Island and along Connecticut's coast.
This is a densely populated area with a lot of real estate that, if it were damaged, would be very expensive to rebuild.
There will be other casualties of the storm. New York may close its subway and regional train lines for the first time since 9/11. It's not just the predictable businesses that will be hurt either. Think about it. Movie box office sales are expected to be dismal on the East Coast this weekend. In Ocean City, Maryland, alcohol sales have been banned, so people will have no incentive to stick around. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Well, one of the effects of the stalling economy has been companies deciding not to go public. This month alone, at least 17 tech firms have put off initial public offerings. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Venture capitalists pour billions into startups every year. Facebook, Twitter, Groupon, all got healthy doses of venture capital. And eventually, those investors want their money back.
So they're anxious because they would like to get a good price for not such a long holding period.
Kathy Smith is with Renaissance Capital. She says when IPOs slow down, because the markets are unpredictable as they are now, it takes investors longer to cash out. Vikram Mancharamani teaches finance at Yale.
Venture capitalists harvest their investments and then recycle that capital into new investments.
Mancharamani says if a venture capital firm doesn't turn a profit, it won't spend as freely.
It'll be hard for other startups to get money.
Kathy Smith thinks the IPO market could be slow for at least several weeks. And even if the chill becomes a deep freeze, she says it'll probably only last 6 months. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Well, move over food trucks. The new thing in Boston, Stacey, is the sneaker truck, a traveling shoe store that sells sneakers out the side, just like food trucks sell hot dogs and gyros and whatever
right,
else.
Right.
The Green Street Vault, as it's called, drives around Boston selling shoes. But according to the Boston Herald, some people aren't too happy with it. One old-fashioned shoe store was not pleased when the truck parked out in front and started
that,
selling
shoes.
I can
see what their problem might be with that, yeah.
Well, and that problem was solved pretty quickly. Apparently, it didn't take long for the meter maid to arrive.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
The State Department is expected to give its blessing as soon as today for a controversial oil pipeline. The Keystone XL would carry crude from Alberta, Canada, to refineries in Texas. But as Marketplace's David Gura reports from Washington, it's become a key issue for environmentalists.
Environmentalists have organized 2 weeks of civil disobedience in Washington, protests in President Obama's front yard. I got to the White House yesterday just before noon. It was pouring rain. There were a few families, some tourists, but I didn't see any pipeline protesters.
They were probably in the paddy wagon.
That's Bill McKibben. He heads Tar Sands Action, the group that's organized the sit-in. More than 300 protesters have been arrested. McKibben says the U.S. should not allow the pipeline because of the heavy environmental toll of oil sands production.
This is a really big deal, and President Obama could shut it down by himself and therefore do far more than anything else he's done to usher in a new energy reality.
The Keystone XL is a pivotal issue for environmentalists who have endured a string of defeats in Washington. Last year, a major climate bill collapsed in Congress. Scott Siegel's an energy lobbyist. He says the environmentalists are too focused on symbolism, not real policy.
The environmental community is using their opposition to the Keystone Pipeline as a cat's paw to strike at fossil fuel development wherever it occurs.
It's a tough fight against a project that would create thousands of jobs when unemployment is still high and we're heading into an election year. But McKibben hopes President Obama is listening.
It's the rarest moment of unity for the environmental movement. And I guess in some ways we'll find out if the environmental movement's strong enough to be heard at all inside the White House.
The administration will make a decision by the end of the year. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
We've heard a lot about government spending protests in Greece and Spain. This weekend, tens of thousands of Israelis are planning to protest government cuts there. Daniel Estrin reports from Jerusalem.
Usually when Israelis take to the streets, it has something to do with wars or peace talks with the Palestinians. But for the last month, Israelis have set up tent camps across the country to protest high rental costs. The economic protests are some of the largest demonstrations in Israel's history. Dafi Ben-Zvi, a woman at one of the tent protests, put it this way.
The capitalism system is not working and we can change it.
As much as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is known as a political hawk, he's also known for his economic policies. Earlier in his political career, he helped Israel transition from a socialist-style economy to a more American-style free market. Yet now he acknowledges some changes must be made. Israelis earn half as much as what American workers earn on average, but prices in Israel are double, says Daniel Doron, who heads a pro-market think tank.
You can imagine what a crunch it is for most people here. Most people barely eke it out.
But the more things change, the more they stay the same. The economic rallies last week were canceled after a deadly cross-border attack and renewed rocket fire from Gaza. But next weekend, protesters are planning a million-man march. In Jerusalem, I'm Daniel Estrin for Marketplace.
The head of Libya's transitional government says the rebels could lose the trust of the people if Western governments don't release billions of dollars worth of Muammar Gaddafi's frozen assets and fast. But at this point, Gaddafi himself remains at large, so countries and businesses around the world are left wondering what to do. Just this morning, word that the African Union will not formally recognize the National Transitional Council. That's the rebels. For more, let's bring in an expert in tricky diplomacy, former British Foreign Secretary Lord David Owen. Good morning.
Morning.
Well, Lord Owen, back in April, the so-called BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, came out and denounced the use of force in Libya. Are they in trouble now as countries start to recognize the rebels and want to do business with them?
Well, I think all those skeptics about the use of a no-fly zone to tilt the balance of fighting have got egg on their face. Mm. And I think this is the sort of interventionism that we're going to have to get used to. I've called it a constrained intervention.
Well, when you are a country who does business with Libya, how do you figure out what to do in a situation like this where you don't know what's going to happen with the leadership, but you do want to have an economic future with the country?
Well, I think that in the early days, you hedge your bets and you keep on board with the existing government. I don't think business is there to make political judgments. They've got to have their eyes open and be aware of what may happen in the future, but try and keep open a dialogue with the liberating and protesting element.
And then once it looks like one side is going to emerge, as it does right now, how does the dynamic change? What are you supposed to do at that point?
Well, you work with whoever's the government of the day, if you're in business. And we already recognize the Transitional Council, and it won't be long, in my judgment, before they declare themselves the government of the country, and most sensible countries recognize the reality.
When you were the foreign secretary, did you ever deal with a situation like this where you had one government changing over very quickly to another and you had to adjust your policy toward that government?
Well, I inherited a situation where southern Rhodesia was in so-called rebellion against the crown. We had an Anglo-American plan to try and peacefully negotiate a settlement. But as, of course, we all know, Robert Mugabe, having done an initial reconciliation, then led his country into total chaos. It's a tragic story.
What did you learn from that situation?
That personalities really matter. I came to the conclusion, actually, he would not make a good future prime minister. It was not for my to make the choice, but I certainly tried to engineer a process where he would not become prime minister. But in the end of the day, the people spoke and they voted for him, and we had to live with that.
How prepared do you think these Libyan rebels are to take over the country and its economy?
I think they're very prepared, and I think we're underestimating them. The transitional team began to develop more coherence, spoke to other countries, developed sensible proposals, came out with a constitution, made the decision that none of them would stand for election, which is crucially important in a transitional period, and have pledged themselves to have an election with 8 months. Now, if they can achieve that, that would be a fantastic transition.
Former British Foreign Secretary Lord David Owen, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
The Scottish government has plans to create tens of thousands of new jobs and billions of dollars of extra revenue from renewable energy. It's pinning most of its hopes on wind power. Scotland is one of the windiest parts of Europe, and we sent Marketplace's Stephen Beard to check it out.
In the hills above the small Scottish village of Fintree, local resident David Howell shows off some of the town's most valuable assets.
What we've got here is we've got 15 turbines in total. We own 1/15 of the output.
The villagers struck a deal with the company that built the wind farm. Fintree residents are paying off the capital cost of one of the turbines. In return, they get 1/15 of the revenue from the electricity generated.
It's not a bunch of suits coming up from the capital city to make a lot of money out of your environment. You actually have a stake in it.
When it's paid for the turbine, the village could make $750,000 a year from the wind farm. Howell's wife, Kate, says Fintry intends to spend the money installing biomass boilers and other renewable energy equipment to wean itself off increasingly expensive oil.
You have to really make a stand and do something to cut your costs and help the environment at the same time.
So this is a tremendous boon on your doorstep here.
It is, absolutely.
Another Fintry resident, Kelly McIntyre, says the whole of Scotland could be on the brink of a new energy bonanza.
We could be the Saudi Arabia of renewables. It is really a golden age for Scotland.
The Scottish Government says that with its wind and powerful tides, Scotland could become the green energy powerhouse of Europe, generating 100,000 new jobs. But public policy consultant Tom Myers is not persuaded.
The problem with renewable energy is that it's less efficient than conventional sources of power.
It has to be subsidised through higher electricity prices for all, and that, he says, won't create more jobs.
If you're taking money from one industry and giving it to another, almost by definition there can be no net gain in jobs. And normally when you subsidise an industry at the expense of other industries, there's a net loss of jobs.
He says there's unlikely to be a bonanza for the Scottish economy as a whole, although he concedes that the people of Fintry may do very well because of wind power. In Fintry, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeremy, a new planet has just been discovered in the Milky Way. And it is made entirely out of diamond.
Really?
Yes. It has roughly the same mass as Jupiter, which could make it the biggest diamond in the universe, potentially.
I'll say, yeah, that sounds huge.
And if you're wondering how much it's worth, which, you know, this is Marketplace, of course, this is the first thing that pops into our heads. So diamonds, I don't know if you've ever... If you're a big diamond buyer, Jeremy.
No, I've never, I don't own any diamonds. I have no idea what they cost, but I probably a lot more than I could afford.
Well, they're $5,000 a carat, which is kind of amazing. And this planet has the number of carats is apparently 10 to the 30th power.
Wow.
Yeah, which could mean that it could actually be bigger than our budget deficit. You can imagine that.
Well, I bet there's a race on now. Now they're thinking they shouldn't have retired the shuttle so quickly.
I know. It's a mere 4,000 light years away, so.
Better to start now than later, I guess.
I know. We could pin our budget hopes on that, maybe, instead of Congress.
There you go. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith, in for Steve Chiatakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.